position. Yep.
I think Neil is going to give us an educational session on what makes a good benchmark. The reason we're doing this at this point in time. It really just is the first step in preparing our ask why some of these questions.
Tim.
Sorry. I'm used to caring.
Wow, right under the bus. Jeez, I didn't even bat an eye. Yeah, that was natural.
Let me start over. I very much would. We're at an investment benchmark educational session this morning for Eileen Neal. The reason we're doing that at this point in time is this is the first step toward preparing an asset liability study later in the year. We did last an asset liability study in 2015. Feels like it was fairly recent, but it was actually 5 years ago that we started down the path that we're currently on here. So as we go through this, we want to do a review of what makes a good benchmark. That's today's session, strictly educational. We'll come back at next month's second meeting and make some recommendations if there are benchmarks that need that we think could be improved upon in order to be more representative of the asset classes that they track. And that'll lead into some review with the trustees about what your main concerns are with the portfolio for today and moving forward. And come back with final recommendations on the asset liability study and any recommended changes as we get into the early summer period. So it sounds like a lot. It's a couple of iterative steps along the way. And it is one of the most important things we do as a board, as an organization, is set this asset allocation and get it implemented. So this will be strictly educational. We want to talk about what's working and what could possibly be improved and why there are some mismatches in benchmarks today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eileen to walk you through the presentation.
Thank you, Tim. I believe that it's green.
No.
Good morning, everyone, and Happy New Year.
Red is on, just FYI.
So,
you're good. You're good.
I'm good.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to be walking you through the benchmarking goals discussion that we put together. And so start off with the first slide. Why do benchmarks matter? And, as a board, your most important decision that you make, as Tim just articulated, is to determine the asset allocation policy. I would say the second most important decision you make as a board is determining the benchmarks associated with that asset allocation policy in terms of the overall total fund asset allocation policy, individual asset class benchmarks, and sub-asset class benchmarks. And they're important because they help you as a board execute your fiduciary duty, and your fiduciary, one of your primary fiduciary duties is the monitoring and oversight of the investment program. And the asset allocation reflects your strategic direction, if you will, for the fund. And what benchmarks do is help you measure the efficacy of that strategic decision. How well are you doing relative to the goals and objectives you set for yourself? So the benchmarks are important from that perspective. They're important because if they're selected properly, they reflect importantly your risk tolerance, right? You've developed an asset allocation that is reflective of your risk tolerance. So the benchmarks, again, enable you to measure those the risk that you're taking relative to the benchmark. Benchmarks, again, provide that link in between expectations and success, and they also provide a mechanism for you to monitor the implementation aspect of the program. So asset allocation is strategic. What staff does in selecting managers and strategies is the implementation of that strategic decision that you make as a board. And so benchmarks enable you to evaluate that set of decisions, the implementation decisions, i.e. the strategies that have been selected to populate the asset classes that you have chosen as a board. So, again, benchmark selection is a very important decision that you make as a board. Luckily, given that important decision, we do have criteria that we as investment professionals, consultants, and your staff follow, guidelines, if you will, that help us understand whether or not benchmarks possess the qualities which make them suitable, i.e. optimal benchmarks to employ for the asset classes and sub-asset classes that you invest in. And so there are seven what we call criteria for evaluating benchmark quality listed on this page, and I'll go through them kind of quickly just to give you an idea of how they factor into this determination. So the first one is specified in advance. So here we say the benchmark is specified prior to the start of the evaluation period and known to all parties. So you're all familiar with the S&P 500. That's probably a good example to use in terms of helping you understand how these criteria are applied to benchmarks. So the S&P 500 is a published benchmark. It has a set of decision rules that are very clear. They're written, they're followed in a consistent basis. So the S&P 500 meets that first criteria because we know what the constituents are and what the weightings of those constituents are and the prices associated with those securities at the beginning of whatever your measurement period is and really throughout your measurement period. The second criteria is appropriate, and that is that the benchmark is appropriate for the particular strategy or, again, asset class or sub-asset class. And the way that we generally tend to determine that is by evaluating the characteristics of the benchmark, not just the returns, but the exposures to, and continue with our S&P 500, you know, we know what the sector exposures are, we know what the yield, the dividend yield is, we know what the risk of that benchmark is. And so when we're looking at strategies, and it would be a large cap equity strategy that the S&P 500 is appropriate for, we really want to see a very close matchup in those main factors that will drive the returns and risk of that strategy. So that's how we help understand the appropriateness.
Scott?
Question. When I read this, it struck me as odd to say that a benchmark is consistent with a manager's investment style, because we've all had managers whose investment style was to lose money. So that it struck me that you know, a benchmark being suited to a manager, it just struck me as a little odd, and I'm wondering, I don't suppose that's what was intended, that's what's written, but, you know, when you look at private equity, where you have the difficulty of measurement, it struck me that this statement doesn't seem to fit nicely in that category in terms of trying to identify one. So did I read this literally correctly, or is this...
No, and you are correct, and if you will just hold that thought for a moment, we're going to talk about that, actually, in a bit of detail, about whether or not some of the benchmarks of your strategies actually are, or where they are relative to these criteria. Excuse me. Measurable is another criteria, and that is the benchmark return. It's readily calculable on a reasonably frequent and consistent basis. Again, going back to our S&P 500 example, clearly there are prices that are listed in real time for the S&P 500, so it's very easy to calculate a return for any measurement period that you are interested in. So the rules are clear, they're not really subject to interpretation. Unambiguous is where the benchmark securities, they're known, and the weights are also known in the benchmark. So again, going back to the S&P 500, because of those clear benchmark construction rules, we know exactly what issues are in the S&P and at what weights at any point in time. And again, the rules are very clear and not really subject to interpretation. Reflective of current investment opinions, essentially you can interpret this as, and this refers to portfolio strategies, managed strategies, that the manager owns the benchmark. The manager is comfortable that the benchmark is really reflective of the strategy that the manager is implementing, and they're aware, they're able to evaluate the decisions that they're making, the risk exposures and so forth relative to that benchmark. Also, accountable, which kind of goes with reflective of current opinion, and that simply is that the manager has high conviction and accepts accountability for the performance of their portfolio relative to the benchmark. If the benchmark is truly a good fit, they don't have a lot of cover, if you will, to say, well, you know, that benchmark isn't really optimal, and so, you know, that's why, you know, we perform so differently. And for public markets managers, that should never be a conversation, really, that you're having if we've done a good job in selecting the appropriate benchmark. And then lastly, investable. A good quality benchmark is one, because you know the individual securities, you know them at the beginning of the period, you know what their weights are, that you can simply develop a passive portfolio to replicate the benchmark. So those are the criteria that we generally look at in evaluating the quality of benchmarks. There's some other criteria that that we apply that aren't part of that sort of industry standard that everyone employs. And that is, as you develop your asset allocation policy, you're doing so based on an asset allocation study where there have been inputs that represented capital market assumptions or expected returns that come from proxies for those market segments or benchmarks. And in the case of our relationship with you and our annual asset allocation review that we conduct with you, we actually show you what those benchmark proxies are for each of those asset classes that you're contemplating investing in. So you want those to line up, ideally. So that, again, goes back to if you're setting expectations and you're using a benchmark to measure the success of your decisions, you want that benchmark to be aligned with that initial thinking that went into selecting the asset allocation policy that you selected. We also have been talking a lot about return and prices and characteristics, but reflective of risk is another criteria that we like to evaluate, and is very important from our perspective, because whatever underlying factors, risk factors that drive the benchmark will also drive the portfolio, or should be driving the portfolio, and we should understand that. So, going back to our S&P 500 example, that is a U.S. stock benchmark. Well, we know that the two key drivers of risk and return in a U.S. stock portfolio are its size exposures and its style exposures. Is it large cap or small cap? Is it growth or value? So those are risk characteristics that we try to match up with the individual benchmark strategy. So we do pay a lot of attention to risk. The third point here, that it's available in a timely and cost-efficient manner. Well, the S&P 500, again, it's available on a daily basis. You can look at it in real time online. And it's very low cost to either implement or to access. This is not the case for, let's say, a private equity peer group universe. And we're going to talk about peer group universes in a moment. But that's an example of a benchmark that is typically used and is not available in a timely manner. It's generally lagged, and it's generally costly to procure. So just to give you an example of a benchmark that would be low quality based on that particular criteria. And then lastly, consider best practices. Clearly, there are benchmarks that are used by not only yourselves, but many of your peers and other institutional investors because they best reflect that asset class or sub-asset class that you're invested in. So we thought it'd be helpful to understand the types of benchmarks that you can employ. There's actually quite an array. And what I've done here is I am listing the benchmark type, and then I'm assessing that benchmark based on those quality criteria, both those seven criteria and then the additional ones we just reviewed. And then I'm giving you examples, and these are all examples of Contra Costa current benchmarks. So you can immediately see where they fall on the spectrum in terms of their quality as a benchmark for your particular strategy. So the first type of benchmark are the public markets asset class benchmarks. So those are the published benchmarks like the S&P 500, or in your case, you're using the Russell 3000 for all of your equity composite, the MSCI All Country World Index for non-US, and the Bloomberg Barclays for bonds. Those are high in benchmark quality because they meet just about all of those seven criteria plus the additional ones I mentioned. I have relative in parentheses because this is a benchmark that you're comparing relative to your portfolio. The next category is what we call public market strategy style. So that's kind of going down another level from the asset class level benchmark, and that is where we're taking into account things like a specific style exposure a manager may be implementing or a size exposure. And I give examples like the Russell 2000 value, Russell 2000 growth, and on the fixed income side, a short-term fixed income benchmark, in this case the Bloomberg Barclays government credit 1 to 3 year. So these are also benchmarks that you compare relative to your portfolios, and they are also high quality because they meet all of those benchmark criteria. Excuse me. The next benchmark type are what we call blended benchmarks. So those are benchmarks that are weighted, that are the aggregates of some weighted subcomponent benchmarks. And I give as examples your total fund policy, which is all of your asset classes aggregated up in the weights and their target weights, as well as your risk parity benchmark, which is a 60-40 blend of equities and bonds. And those also are high quality or moderate. And I say moderate, I'm thinking more of your total fund policy benchmark, because that benchmark includes not only the public market asset class benchmarks, but your private market asset class benchmarks. And in a moment, we'll talk about those, and those are not high-quality benchmarks. There's also real return benchmarks, and I call that an absolute type of benchmark because that's kind of like a hurdle rate. You're looking to meet or exceed a specific level of return. And in this case, you have one strategy that is benchmarked to the CPI plus 4%, or maybe two strategies. And that's a low-quality benchmark. Can anyone guess why that's a low-quality benchmark? We don't know if it's specified in advance. Remember, the CPI is a government-created indicator that comes out kind of after the fact, after they've aggregated a fair amount of accounting and economic data. It's not measurable. It's not readily calculable. It's only published a couple of months after they actually determine what the CPI is for that, whatever that measurement period is. And it's also not available in real time as a result of that. So when you think about those seven criteria for benchmark quality, a CPI really meets virtually none of those. So that is why we consider that a low-quality benchmark. The next category is benchmark plus. So if you think about your private equities, that's S&P plus 4%. That is a public markets benchmark plus a premium. In this case, 4% for the private equity benchmark. Well, you might ask, well, why is that low? It's got the S&P, which is a high-quality benchmark. And it is. until you bolt that 4% on top of the S&P 500. And that turns it into a low-quality benchmark, because then it's something different. It's something that potentially has different risk characteristics. It's not something that you know. How do you create that 4% in terms of building a portfolio? So by introducing that premium, that converts that public markets benchmark, which is a very high-quality benchmark, into a overall low-quality benchmark, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. The next category is an absolute return, or hurdle rate, or a single number, 7.5%. So a lot of times, funds that, such as yourselves will use your discount rate assumption as a benchmark, as another benchmark for your total fund. And, obviously that is a rate that we want to meet and hopefully exceed. But the point is that in and of itself is not a good benchmark, because it doesn't meet any of those criteria that we talked about earlier. The next benchmark is a peer universe, and that's a relative universe, because again, we're comparing either our total fund results or our asset class results or our manager results against some peer group. And the peer group is really not a group of securities, but it's a group of portfolios. It's, if you look at, I listed here the public funds greater than $1 billion universe, you would be a member of that universe, and a number of your county peers would be a member of that universe, but it would be just your total fund return. There would be no look through to see what your individual securities are, and there is no look through to see what your asset allocation is compared to other funds in that peer group. And that same distinction applies to all peer groups, and so that's why the benchmarks, in addition to not meeting the seven criteria, they're also not available on a timely basis, typically, particularly if you're looking at private markets. Those are lagged at least a quarter, and they may not be cost-effective as well, and they certainly are not investable. The last category is one that you may not be that familiar with. It is a newer kind of trending benchmark type, and it's called the public markets equivalent, and that's also a relative return type of benchmark, and it has moderate quality. And what the premise is behind the public markets equivalent is it's a public markets benchmark that's used to measure private equity performance, because it takes the actual fund's cash flows and calculates an IRR for that public. So let's say you want to compare your private equity portfolio against the S&P, just the S&P. We would take the S&P and we would calculate an internal rate of return using the cash flows of your private equity investment. Let's say it's a technology private equity venture capital fund. So all of the cash flows in and out of that fund would be applied to that S&P 500, and you calculate an internal rate of return for your private equity portfolio and one for the S&P, and that gives you a linkage then to the public markets, and it's a much better measure. So that's why we say it's a moderate benchmark, not a low-quality benchmark, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Are there any questions at this point before I proceed?
Yes, you do have one. John?
Susan, I guess it's John. Eileen, would you describe a little bit how you would apply a benchmark to Dodge & Cox? For example, they have a very different style. And so in a year in which the S&P 500, I'm talking about a managed equity fund, large cap equity fund, in some years they're going to be well above, some years they're going to be well below. Probably takes 5 years anyway to get an average that you might compare to directly to the S&P 500. What do you do in that kind of case?
So that's a very good example. I don't believe for Dodge and Cox that there is a good published benchmark alternative. And why is that? So for those of you that aren't familiar with Dodge and Cox, they're in a U.S., mostly U.S., they do manage non-U.S., but they have a very big U.S. equity mutual fund. They have a pretty strong value bias, but they're not a value manager. And they also have a pretty strong small cap bias, but they're not a small cap manager. They're not even really a mid cap manager. So they are a large cap manager that will have a lower cap relative to the S&P 500, which I believe is the benchmark for their portfolio, and they'll have a persistent value tilt as well. And what I would tend to do is probably create a custom benchmark that maybe is a blend of a large cap and small value type of benchmark, or even a factor risk oriented benchmark, to really match their style relative to that benchmark, to measure where they're really adding value. But, you know, it's a mutual fund. Mutual fund benchmarks tend to be very general and don't tend to always be the best match for that particular style. But in that example, you know, that's how thoughtful I think we need to be when we're benchmarking your portfolios, is the process that I described to you, because of the fact that you are evaluating, again, the success of, in this case, a manager's ability to add value. You want to get as precise as you can without over-engineering, which is a delicate balance. So what I did was I went through your portfolio, every single account and composite, and I listed all of the benchmarks, the benchmark types, as we just reviewed, the benchmark types, and then rated them on benchmark quality. So the good news is you see a lot of green. That means the benchmark quality is very high for the majority of your portfolios, because the majority of your portfolios are public markets portfolios, which are very easy to benchmark with high quality benchmarks that do adequately reflect the underlying strategies. There are a couple reds, however, and they are all your private markets portfolio. So the private credit portfolio is a benchmarks plus. The real estate portfolio, private real estate portfolio, is a peer group. The Wellington portfolio, which is an inflation hedging strategy, has a real return benchmark, which is low quality, as well as the Parametric portfolio. And then private equity, S&P plus 4%. So what we thought I do here is talk just quickly about the public markets in terms of considerations for benchmark selection, and then really spend more time on the private markets, because as we just saw, for your public market portfolios, it's a pretty easy decision, right? We have a plethora of benchmarks from which to select for all the strategies that you invest in, and they meet all the benchmark criteria. And the only other comment I would make with respect to selecting benchmarks in the public markets is that we would like those benchmarks to be as broad and as representative of the opportunity set as possible. That is the philosophy that we generally apply in determining the proxies for our capital market assumptions for your asset classes and sub-asset classes. And that is a philosophy that you as a board, that we would suggest that you also apply in selecting benchmarks for your asset classes and sub-asset classes. Try and be as broad as possible. And you have been. And I've illustrated the benchmarks for the major asset class exposures that you employ. And I would say in every one of those cases, those are the broadest benchmarks that you could be applying to those respective strategies.
Jay,
can you clarify your last point about wanting a broad benchmark that captures the opportunity set with the earlier comments about the appropriate benchmark for dodging costs, perhaps distinguishing between, you know, kind of asset class and manager level benchmarks?
Right, so thank you. That's a good question. So again, you as a board are setting the strategic direction through the asset allocation decision, And so the asset classes that you select to reflect the various betas, if you will, so your equities, your fixed income, you want to take advantage of the broadest opportunity set, because by taking advantage of the broadest opportunity set, that helps you increase the probability of actually achieving your expectation for that asset class, right? So, for example, U.S. equities. U.S. equities have large cap, small cap, growth, and value. If you selected only the S&P 500 as your opportunity set, well, it's capturing 90% of the U.S. equity market, but you would not be capturing 10% of the equity market. And we want to capture as much of that equity market in your portfolio as possible. So by selecting, as you have, the Russell 3000, then you populate that with strategies that meet that benchmark and give you that broadest exposure to all of the style and size companies within the U.S. equity market. When it comes down to implementation decision, that's actually finding individual strategies, and if you're hiring active managers, you want them to be highly skilled managers. You want a benchmark that helps you evaluate whether what they're providing for you is really skill or not skill. And the way that you make that determination is selecting a benchmark that closely matches their particular strategy. So in the case, let's say you hired Dodge & Cox, Russell 3000 wouldn't be the right benchmark for them. That's not where they're fishing. They're fishing in large and mid and small caps, but not the broad market, and more of the value-oriented securities. We know that about them. We think that they could have a role in the portfolio, but let's make sure we benchmark them appropriately so that when they're either outperforming or underperforming, we understand whether that's attributable to their issue selection skill, which is what we want, or if it's, well, they had a small cap bias versus a large cap benchmark. That's not necessarily an indication of skill. So that's why we really pay close attention to how we benchmark individual managers. We want our managers to be skillful. We don't want to be surprised. One of the ways we do that is we make sure that we have a benchmark that really adequately captures how they think about putting portfolios together and the types of risk exposures that they will demonstrate as a result of their portfolio construction process. Did that answer your question? Okay. So private markets, that's where we saw all the low quality benchmarks. And there's actually three types of benchmarks within the private markets. As I mentioned, at Contra Costa, you're using a combination of either public markets plus a premium, or peer group for your real estate. And then there's that third category, public markets equivalent, I mentioned earlier. So I've got those three types of benchmarks, and to give you a sense of the distinctions between these three types of benchmarks. So I think we've already defined the three groups. The calculation methodology differs. So the public markets plus benchmark uses a time-weighted rate of return calculation methodology. So don't worry about that distinction right now, because I'm going to provide you an example that compares time-weighted rate of return to the internal rate of return, but just know that that is one distinction between that benchmark type and the other two benchmark types, which both use an internal rate of return calculation. How commonly are these benchmark types used? Well, the most commonly used benchmark for private markets is the type that you're using, which is the benchmark, the public markets plus type of benchmark. The peer group is typically used by large, sophisticated plan sponsors because they feel that the public markets plus really isn't reflective of the types of strategies that they're investing in. They like the peer groups because they believe that by comparing my private equity portfolio relative to a group of private equity portfolios that my peers invest in, that gives me a better sense of whether I've done a good job of picking my private equity partnerships. So that's the rationale behind utilization of the peer group. The public markets equivalent return calculation or benchmark is used by probably your private equity manager, StepStone, as well as other private equity consultants and fund-of-funds, and is beginning to be employed by some large, sophisticated plan sponsors. The quality of the benchmarks are low for Public Markets Plus and peer group, but I would say moderate to high, depending on how you employ the public markets equivalent benchmark. In terms of the pros and cons of these three, the Public Markets Plus, well, that's pretty easy to understand, right? It's a public market benchmark you're familiar with, and you just add a premium to it. It is generally employed by a lot of your peers, so you're not out of the you're not out in the tail, if you will, by utilizing this type of benchmark. The big con of this benchmark is what we call misfit risk relative to the other two benchmark types for private markets. And we've seen that in spades, really, in the last year, as we've seen public markets returning, 20 to 30%, and private equity portfolios, because they can write down, but they can't write up their good holdings, and have a different valuation and pricing methodology. They just all have returned very differently, and that's because of this lag and misfit with the public markets. The peer group has less misfit because you're measuring the performance of your private equity portfolio versus the performance of other private equity portfolios that are also using an internal rate of return calculation methodology. So you eliminate two sources of misfit, the pricing and methodology that you have with the Public Markets Plus premium. The issue with the con, if you will, with the peer group, though, is all the con of all peer groups. There's survivor bias, selection bias, the peer groups lag. They're not frozen, so you may look at the June return for a peer group in September, and it's one number, and you may look at that June return in December, and it's a different number. Why? Because more plan sponsors have populated the peer group, or they've revised their initial returns that they put in the peer group. So it's not perfect, although it does eliminate a fair amount of that misfit risk. And then the public markets equivalent, it allows a direct comparison between the public markets and the private markets. Remember that example I gave earlier? It is more complex to calculate. It does require a custom model, which is, it's not very difficult, but it's harder to convey how it's calculated and to present it to boards such as yourself. But it does virtually eliminate that benchmark misfit risk that we do try and minimize. That is a risk that we, whenever we're selecting benchmarks, we are very cognizant of the fact, it goes back to being the appropriate benchmark. An appropriate benchmark is not going to have a lot of misfit. I'm going to stop there a minute and see if you all have any questions.
Are there any questions? I see one. Jerry?
I don't know where it's standard in the industry to use the word quality to describe something like low quality. It seems like such a value judgment. I'm wondering whether or not something like correlation or equivalency or applicability or whatever might be less judgmental about the benchmark, because it seems to me that it's pretty clear that we're trying to compare our returns, if you will, to something that is equivalent to us or correlates to us or is as close as equal to us, and to somehow label it as low quality, I think without enough reference to an uninitiated reader, they might think that it's a basket of crap, for lack of a better, less, more artful word.
Is it make sense to consider something like that, or is that a standard acceptability for the for a description of a benchmark being low quality?
So I refer you back to the slide that I've just flipped back to on your slide three. That label of low or high quality is solely a function of how well that benchmark fulfills these criteria, these seven criteria for benchmark quality. So the less of these criteria you see in that particular benchmark, then the lower quality it is, solely based upon the benchmark quality's criteria. So a high quality benchmark is, it maybe has 5 out of 7, or maybe 7 out of 7. A low quality benchmark may only meet 1 or 2 out of 7. That's how we make that determination. It's not random. It is simply a function of, we know what those seven criteria are. How, you know, can we check those boxes for a particular benchmark? How many of those boxes can we check?
And is that industry acceptable terminology? Saying that low quality versus high quality?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is.
I mean, sir. Building on Jerry's comment,
We have a nice chart showing all of our investments with either red or green.
Yes.
The presumption I would think of most readers is, why do we have any reds? Why shouldn't they all be greens? How do you respond to that?
So that is kind of where we're coming to here, is, you know, we're going to be undertaking this asset liability study, and that is a good time. You know, you're revisiting your asset allocation policy, the most important decision you make as a group. We've already established at the beginning of this presentation, probably the second most important decision you make are the benchmarks. So it's a good time to revisit your benchmarks when you're undertaking your asset liability study. And so what we wanted to do here is kind of discuss these issues related to benchmark selection and quality benchmarks, and for you to understand that for the majority of your portfolio, benchmarks are fine, probably don't need to revisit them, although we will, but we probably should take a much closer look at those areas where we have benchmarks that, you know, at least on slide 8 here, we have different ways of benchmarking private market portfolios, and there is at least two methodologies that might be better than your prevalent one, which is a public benchmark plus. And the public market equivalent would certainly raise you to a moderate to high for those private market portfolios. So we will be examining this and looking to improve the benchmarks on those portfolio components where we currently have low-quality benchmarks. And by the way, you know, all your peers are wrestling with this because there is no panacea. There is no perfect way to benchmark private market portfolios. It really is a function of how important benchmarking is to you and how much effort you want to put into it. I think as fiduciaries, you want to put a reasonable amount of effort into selecting good benchmarks, which are fairly representative of the strategies that you're implementing. And so that is really going to be our goal with this upcoming study.
Yeah, I would just echo that. I mean, where a high-quality benchmark exists, we seek it out and we use it, full stop. Where it doesn't exist, we're going through this exercise to say, can we improve? Can we improve on the limited partnerships where we always have this mismatch and we have to measure over a 10-year time period relative to what we could have gotten in the public markets? And I think it's a somewhat less satisfying discussion because there's not an investable benchmark there. What we're saying is with this public market equivalent, and it gets a little bit weedy how you calculate it, but it's basically saying for every cash flow that went into that fund, if we had invested in the public markets, what would we have done? It's like you're moving in a direction of a better fit. And so it's a, you know, where we see low quality, I view it as low information. It's less informative. It's maybe less applicable to your language there. And can we move that measurement forward to a higher quality, whether that's up to moderate or a high quality. How far can we get along that pathway here through this process? And it's, you know, we're never going to have green across the board as long as we have private markets and some of the alternatives. They're simply not represented in a high-quality index today. But can we move the ball forward, essentially?
And I think the other point of, important point of that as well, and when you talk about green versus red, you think about, oh, green's good, red's not so good or bad, is that I think looking back, I think that we, you know, Cicera was not wrong in having the benchmarks that we've had. You know, it's very typical to use the ones that we've had in the past, and like Tim mentioned, it's a good time to revisit and say, okay, given the information that's available today in 2020, can we improve on some of these?
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a green versus red argument. It's more of, okay, what's more appropriate and what's, you know, what's more effective in this exercise?
Yeah, I would agree with that. We've always used the best available. We're asking the question, is the best available somewhat better than what we've been using? Is there a better implementation?
Okay, Jay, then Scott, then Jerry.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great conversation, some great points around private markets benchmarking. And I think it really highlights the need for a nuanced conversation at the board level when there's some kind of performance evaluation and the need for, you know, a fully staffed, very capable staff to run a complex portfolio that's not just measurable with one metric. So I think that's great. The slide on page 8 is a nice comparison of the different benchmarks. Would you mind clarifying for me or reminding us what the premium, the basis for including a premium in the public markets plus line, what's a premium stand for? And, you know, why on something like the private public markets equivalent there's no premium?
Sure. Good question. So the theory is you go into, and we'll just use private equity as our example, you go into private equity because, you know, through engineering companies, either through the balance sheet or creating new products or whatever it is in the private market, you're able to achieve a higher return relative to investing in public market and publicly traded and managed companies. And also there is the liquidity associated with private markets. And so I don't think it's been terribly scientific how we've arrived at the premium. I would say the average today is public markets plus 3%. You all are at 4%, probably a little bit higher, but the premium is roughly at the 3%, and that basically represents the additional risk from illiquidity, the additional risk that, you know, in the case of venture capital companies, 20% of them fail, right? So, you know, you have a very wide potential range of outcomes in private markets portfolios, which are greater than public markets portfolios, and hence, you know, if you're going to get paid for taking that additional risk, that's what's encompassed in the premium. The public markets equivalent doesn't include a premium because, again, you're making that direct linkage. So I'll go back to my example. Let's say you have two options. You can invest in the S&P 500, or you can invest in TPG Fund 4, right? That's a buyout private equity fund. So let's say you put a dollar in the S&P and a dollar in your TPG on the same day, and then you calculate the internal rate of return of both. And depending upon, you know, the dollars that you put in subsequently and the dollars that you get back in distribution, you know, an internal rate of return calculation is from, you know, the beginning date to some either measurement period or terminal date, right? You don't calculate a quarterly return. You calculate one return. So you calculate your investment in the S&P with the same cash flows as the investment in your TPG Fund 4, and then you, at whatever your measurement date is, you compare the two, and using that internal rate of return calculation. And then you'll see just the difference in those returns, you know, how that private equity portfolio and the S&P 500 treated in the same manner as that private equity portfolio compare. So that's what makes them equivalent. You get rid of the pricing and valuation issues of comparing a time weighted rate of return benchmark versus an internal rate of return investment, number one. And number two, you're actually taking those same cash flows and applying them to that S&P so that the only thing that really is left is either the skill or the success of that investment. So that's why you don't need a premium.
Right. But at the end of the day, if you have a public, let's say your TPG Fund 4 returns in line with S&P marks, you know, adjusted for cash flow timing. If you had the same return, would you say that was a successful investment?
That's a good question. I think there's two ways of answering that, right? Was it successful as an equity investment? I would say yes, it provided me an equity return. Was it successful as a private equity investment? Well, how did other private equities perform during that? Did they all perform similar to the S&P, or did this one perform like the S&P and they all did maybe way better, like a couple hundred basis points better? Then I would say, well, that specific investment wasn't successful. So, you know, there is this question about, is private equity a good idea? Or is just this one private equity investment a problem? That's, I think, what a lot of people confuse when they're comparing public markets versus private markets. And I think you really should just be focused. You've made the decision to go into the private markets. Just be focused on the success of that private market strategy.
Yes, so I wonder if at the end of the calculation process you're going to make some evaluation anyway on what a fair premium should have been for that fund.
Well, after 10 or 15 years, you could probably make
that. Yeah, maybe someone else will be around.
I don't think you could make that in less than that kind of a period.
And just one follow-up question. Seeing as how, as you referenced at the beginning of the presentation, one of the most important jobs is to develop the strategic asset allocation, can you remind us, for private markets, what capital market assumptions are used in determining kind of the long-run estimated return?
Sure. So when Verus is developing its private markets assumptions, it is basically risk adjusting, if you will, public markets. So we're starting as our base a public markets benchmark, I think it is S&P 500. And then we're adjusting it for the amount of leverage and also to some degree the higher risk that we've observed in actual private equity portfolios. So it's a forward looking, we're not looking backwards, we're looking forward, and we're trying to reflect the fact that particularly in the case of buyouts, which is the majority of private markets investments, there is a level of balance sheet or financial engineering reflective of the additional leverage, and that's what we're trying to capture is that component, that additional component.
Is there an estimated premium built in for illiquidity or private manager skill?
I'm trying to remember the process here, but I believe it's a beta adjustment.
It is a beta adjustment.
Yeah, so
just leverage
not
equity.
An explicit premium, but a risk factor adjustment.
Which is quite interesting.
You're seeing more variability than public market book.
Okay.
Scott?
trying to figure out where to begin, but I guess I'll try to simplify it. Not that it's a driver, but I do want to know when we come back to this discussion, whatever the schedule was in April or what have you, what the peer group use is, particularly amongst the 37 Act plans for PME versus peer group on your page 8 breakdown. So that's something I want to know, just as a data point, an information point. Two, on the judgment of PME on its quality, where you have it moderate to high, is that solely based on using the 1 to 7 factors on page 2 and deciding how many of them it meets or doesn't meet?
Correct.
No other value judgment into that?
No.
Okay. And the source of that is a 2007 publication, it looks like, Managing Investment Portfolios. Is that right?
Yes. It's actually been published in other papers as well, but that's where that particular set of definitions came from.
And is that considered the standard? I mean, is that the accepted standard?
Yes, yes.
And then third, I don't expect a response today, and it's just maybe more my reaction to this. We're talking about benchmark issues with respect to private markets, particularly on the page 8 discussion.
Yes.
And I guess I'm perplexed in part by the stress of the importance on comparison to public markets or judgments in relation to public markets, when at least from where I sit, a great impetus for being in, whether it's private equity or private credit, is to avoid the public markets, right? The whole disruption, the noise, the volatility, the uncertainty of the public market is presumably avoided by the private credit, the private equity investment to some degree. So I guess I'm perplexed a little bit by judging performance, judging how well we did, judging whether it was a good investment, by continuing to move to a place of measurement that relies on public markets. So I'm not following the logic of that. It may just be not enough coffee today. I don't know. But I just want us to touch on that because I'm not quite following the logic of that all the way through in terms of what we're trying to measure. Because ultimately, it's like, did we make money, right? Did the investment do well? We had an expectation going into it, at least in private equity. When I came on the board, not being familiar with the scale of that investment and how it worked, you know, learning about the J curve, very interesting. Early years of private equity, you're not going to have returns because the capital is being invested, it's being deployed, and then ultimately you start to have returns later. I get that's difficult to measure, but I looked at some of the tortured means by which we might try to fashion a way to evaluate a return, and I'm still perplexed by what happens in the early years of a private equity investment. How do you measure that? And do we need to get wrapped around the axle about it? So anyway, those are thoughts that I hope in April when we have this discussion we can talk about.
Yeah, I can address your question. It's a very good one. A little bit in that, you know, part of the utilization of Public Markets Plus came out of, you know, that was the earliest benchmark employed for when institutional investors started investing in private equity. And it was based on the decision, well, I made the decision to move away from public equities into private equities, so they better perform better than my public equities. And this is the way that I measure it. I take my public equities and I put the premium on it that I expect my private equities to provide me, and that tells me how well my private equities did. And that was the convention for a long time. And you know, it kind of made sense, because what was your alternative to private equity? Going back to public markets, right? But we've moved beyond that, right? We've accepted the fact that, and you mentioned that we expect to get better returns. We would like to avoid some of the issues that, you know, occurs in public markets. And so we're there. Forget about, you know, making that comparison to public markets. What's a better way of benchmarking? And that's when I think the peer groups basically came into vogue. Let's just compare ourselves relative to other private equity investors and make that comparison on vintage years. So to your point, gee, you know, the J-curve has kind of a unique environment. So if you're comparing yourself to similar vintage year funds, they're all going through the J-curve at the same time, right? And so that really had become a more prevalent, as I said, particularly a lot of the state-level funds use the peer groups as their private equity comparison. But I work with one state-level fund, and in particular as a benchmark consultant to them, and you know, they're frustrated by even that comparison because they think, well, you know, we're so much bigger maybe than other constituents. Maybe that's not a fair comparison. So should we be thinking of yet another way? And so, you know, the public market's equivalent is becoming more attractive because even though it's comparing you to a public market benchmark, it's based upon all of the cash flows, and it's based upon the same calculation methodology you're applying to your private equity investment. So at least it gives you some comparison that isn't driven by maybe the way that, you know, Kern County developed their private equity portfolio relative to Contra Costa's private equity portfolio, and it's not a good comparison because we have 80-20 and they're 28 venture and private equity, you see. So there's still a lot of problems associated with benchmarking that we have not been able to resolve. But I would say peer groups is probably better than the benchmark plus. Public markets equivalent may be better than peer group, but those are, again, what we're going to be looking at in the next few weeks. I hope that answers some of your questions.
Jerry?
One last thought on this. I just don't want to have it lost in the shuffle of all the rest. They're very good questions, but I'd really like to, I think inadvertently we are denigrating the benchmarks by describing them as low quality. And that concerns me. It seems to me that not everyone who reads this is going to have the opportunity to have Eileen attached to it or Tim attached to it to explain what it means. It doesn't strike me that benchmark quality is a defined term, really. And so I would really encourage you to think about the possibility of thinking in terms of correlation, accountability, equivalency, relevance, something like that. It's like comparing a yardstick to a 1 meter stick. They're different. And you're never going to be able to stretch a 1 yard stick to be as long as a 1 meter stick. So it's just a different standard. We don't denigrate the 1 meter stick by saying low quality measurement. It's just different. It's a little bit longer than the 1 yard stick. So I just give some thought to possibly changing that nomenclature because I think it's unintentionally denigrating.
I'm happy to.
I'm sorry?
I'm happy to do that.
Consider it. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Anything else before she continues? Okay.
So only a couple more slides here. I did say that we would look at a comparison of the calculation. There's a lot of small print here. Basically, all I want to convey is the time rate of return is based upon you know, the end value minus the beginning value divided by the beginning value for any period, that's what a time-weighted rate of return is comprised of. So if you're looking for a quarterly time-weighted rate of return, you look at the beginning of quarter market value, the end of quarter market value, and then divide that by the beginning of quarter market value. And then if you're putting together multiple periods, then you have to essentially add an exponent, which is 1 divided by n. That's just the mathematical way that you link together multiple periods. For the internal rate of return calculation, you can see that that's very different. There, you're just taking the sum of all the cash flows They have to equal zero at the time that you're making the measurement. So whatever you kind of back into, what discount rate gets you to zero, given all the cash flows that have occurred, and that's your internal rate of return calculation. And you can see that this is just a one-time calculation based upon your measurement period. It doesn't have a lot of meaning for less than 5 years. And then once you get past 5 years, it starts to, and that's past the J-curve period. That's when this calculation starts to give you some sense of how well the investment's actually performing. But they're two very different calculation methodologies. One is you're taking intra-period measurements and putting them together, and the other, you're just taking one measurement of all the periods together.
The way I think about this is, if we're talking about something that's relatively static or relatively stable in balance over time, we invest $100 million into the public equity market and hopefully it grows. Time-weighted rate of return is perfectly acceptable. If we have something where, we start with a dollar and then we go up to $100 and then we drop back down again, well, the incremental change from $1 to $2 in value, we show 100% time-weighted rate of return. From 100 to 110, even though we're 100 to 110 is a bigger move in absolute sense than 1 to 2, time-weighted rate of return doesn't capture that. So when we have drawdown vehicles, we commit a $50 million, it's drawn down over a period of time to return to us, the internal rate of return kind of normalizes the impact of every incremental dollar gain over the life of the fund.
Jay?
Just a quick question on, let's say we did switch over to public market equivalent. How is that incorporated into the quarterly reporting?
It really is hard to do because your quarterly reporting is all time-weighted rates of return. So all of your public markets are time-weighted rates of return. In order to calculate your total fund policy, we do take the bank statement values and calculate a time-weighted rate of return for your private markets to get them to fit into your total fund allocation, but obviously that is not the right way to calculate a return for private markets. But that's what we and all other consultants and staff do in order to calculate your total fund policy and actual returns, is we actually calculate a time-weighted rate of return for all of your private markets investments. So that. Yeah, there's a couple of different ways I've seen that handled. I've had a couple clients that they just put in their policy return in place of their actual private market return if their policy is a benchmark plus type of benchmark. And they just live with the fact that, it's not exactly our private equity return, but the time weighted return calculation of our private equities is not the right return either. So we might as well put our policy return in and reduce some of that impact from that differential between our actual return and the policy return. So there are a number of funds that have handled calculating their total fund returns in that manner.
Great. Thanks.
So we'll have to come up.
Yeah, sounds
we'll
great.
Have to come up with a way to do it.
And we'll take a look at the pros and cons of both at the private asset class level as well as the effect on total fund benchmark. That's what's going to come back to the trustees with some assessment of how difficult is this to implement and how much of an improvement might make these changes.
So just to kind of wrap up in terms of the exercise that we went through and looking at your benchmarks. Again, the majority of the benchmarks are a good fit. How about that? a good fit with the strategies and asset classes. So you are able in those areas to evaluate well how successful your expectations are being met for the majority of your investment program. We do recommend, I think it's clear, revisiting those benchmarks that don't seem to be as good a fit to determine if we can arrive at better benchmarks for those strategies, that handful of strategies. And we're going to use the upcoming asset liability study as the catalyst for undertaking this benchmark review. Just so you know, the industry standard is roughly every 3 to 5 years to review your benchmarks and also to review them in tandem with your asset allocation study. So this is very much in line with what your peers tend to do. We also recommend adoption of a benchmark philosophy and benchmark goal statement and a framework. And so that is something that I'd like to potentially draft up in getting feedback from you all in terms of, you know, what some of your preferences and beliefs are with respect to benchmarking. Some of your peers have done this. They've either incorporated into their investment policy statement or adopted a completely separate benchmark philosophy statement. And I could provide you an example of one actually that I worked with a client to develop last year. It's a large state level fund. But adopting a benchmark philosophy basically gives you then a governance document with respect to how CICERA goes about reviewing, evaluating, and selecting benchmarks and what your criteria are that, you know, in addition, usually plan sponsors adopt the 7 criteria, but there may be other criteria that we would incorporate that would be specific to CICERA. And it would include your philosophy regarding, you know, what you consider to be the main rationale for benchmarking your assets. You know, is it to evaluate how well the board's asset allocation decision is working, how well the staff's implementation decisions in terms of manager selection are working? So it would be probably better for future board members if we develop this policy now, because that means that there will be a culture. You will be setting a culture here at CICERA for establishing the benchmarks for the fund that can be perpetuated then in the future in the same way, in the same manner. So it's a process, not necessarily prescriptive, but one that really captures what's important to you all as a board as you think about the benchmarks that ultimately make their way into the portfolio.
Scott?
So my observation about what you just said is that we've come from a place of a chart that shows a lot of green and some red that maybe an amber light is a better color for. I just heard that we should look at a really holistic reinvention of what we're doing recommendation. I think that's what I just heard. I'm probably being a little harsh in that judgment, but I guess I would ask that when this comes back, I would want, Tim, you know, your thoughts and recommendation about whether and to what extent we need to revisit the entirety of our benchmark discussion, whether we need a governing policy. We seem to be doing pretty well with what we've done. I don't ever believe in the old, we've always done it that way rationale, but on the other hand, we thoughtfully consider every quarter what we're doing against the benchmarks we have. So I'm kind of feeling like the proposal on the table seems to be to sort of put everything out on the table and start over, in the sense of selection, governing policy, and so on. And I didn't think that's what we were doing.
Yeah, I guess I don't view it the same way. I'd say I think what Eileen is suggesting, I don't mean to speak for you, but kind of codifying practice in a very explicit way. So not changing what you've been doing, but saying here are, you know, a more highly detailed delineation of how we arrived at the benchmarks we choose.
And it's just related to benchmarking. I'm not talking about all of the decisions and governance that, is basically articulated in your investment policy statement. This, thinking like a one-pager, essentially, that would be specific to the benchmark selection and evaluation process.
Well, I'm just reacting to the phrase, for instance, benchmark philosophy statement. I mean, I'd like to think that our benchmark philosophy that we have and that we practice is that we try to ascribe the most accurate and best benchmark for each of the individual investment types we have. I should have just written that down. There's the benchmark philosophy. So, come on.
We're recording.
Anyway.
It's recorded, Seth.
Thank you.
Save
me the typing.
Also, it's been a while since the board, and I think Tim knows, has had a discussion on benchmarks and what role they serve in the portfolio and why we have certain benchmarks. And so I think that was part of bringing it back now, especially ahead of the asset liability study. Also, on a quarterly basis, sometimes, manager performance deviates from the benchmark, sometimes slightly, sometimes significantly, either positive or negative. And they say, it's a benchmark mismatch in some way. But I think that, so that comes up every now and then. So, Tim and I have had some conversations around this, and I think that it's important that the board gets a good understanding that we're not just saying, oh, it's a benchmark. At some point it comes into question, if there's a benchmark issue, is that the right benchmark? Is that something we need to look a little deeper at? And I did want to have Varys comment briefly, and you can talk about it more the next time you bring this back as well. But a lot of times if there's deviation of the manager's performance compared to the benchmark, we can say, fundamentally they're doing this versus the benchmark's doing this. But sometimes it can be indicative that the manager isn't following their mandate when they're investing. Can you just talk briefly about what the Varys, the manager research group and you do when it comes to some of those matters when you see them?
Sure. So as part of our work that we do for you in monitoring your managers, we are comparing not just returns and risk relative to the benchmark, but we are looking through the portfolio to understand how the sector allocations may differ, how portfolio average capitalization or size may differ than the benchmark, and where it may differ on those dimensions. So we look at various risk factor metrics to help us understand those, and we don't rely on very short term. We're not going to get too upset if just one quarter we see things not being as we would normally expect to see in the portfolio or in the benchmark relative to each other. But we watch the trend. So, if over several quarters we see what appears to be either the manager not adhering to what we believe to be their portfolio construction discipline, we engage in conversation with the manager as our first point in order to, get questions answered about what we're seeing in the portfolio and what that means. And then based upon those discussions, we either raise a flag with the client because we think a flag needs to be raised, or it satisfies us that there's, just anomalous events occurring in the market, and they actually are adhering to their discipline and constructing the portfolios in the way that we expect them to. So it's really watching over time and then having dialogue with the manager, how we come to a decision, and we do give them time. We do tend to give them several quarters and maybe even a couple of years, because there are times when there are currents or trends in the market that are just, the market has moved away and the manager hasn't. The manager has stayed true to their discipline. And that's what we really try and confirm. you know, we understand that even if we've done a good job in selecting the appropriate benchmark that fits very well and encompasses the key drivers of results in the manager's portfolio, the fact is that in the manager's portfolio may only have 100 stocks or 100 securities, and the benchmark's got 1,000, right? So, you know, there's never going to be perfect alignment all the time. So that's the process.
Looks like you have one more slide.
I do. So slide 11 is the next steps, and this is the final slide. So at the February board meeting, we plan to come back to you with some benchmark change recommendations, and we will also at that point discuss our 2020 capital market assumptions, and we can answer, I think, Trustee Kwan's question at that time specifically, because we'll have it in our materials, our methodology. And then we will, if we feel that in discussions with staff that we want to introduce any additional strategies or asset classes that would require the board approval during the asset allocation process, and we will bring those to you at that meeting as well. And then at the April board meeting, we will be engaging in March in an enterprise risk tolerance process. We've gone through this before with you all. Hopefully you're all familiar with it. If not, I'm happy to explain it. But we'll be engaging in that process in March. It'll be a survey that... Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm battling a little cold. there'll be a survey that we will be providing you in March for your feedback on some of those issues we talked about today, as well as others. And then we will present those results at the April board meeting. And then at the May meeting, we will present our initial asset liability study findings to elicit feedback from you, an initial discussion. And take that back and incorporate that to come back in June with the finalized asset liability study and recommendations.
Any last questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, Eileen.
Thank you all very much for your attention.
Okay.